Okay, so we are back into our Kingdom of God series. I know we've taken a long break from that series for a while here. I've been gone for about a month. Yeah, so now we're getting back into it. We left off. Well, first, we got the signs here joining us. If you want to say hi to all the people online.
Hello.
And then you'll have to bear with me today also. If I skip a verse or something, you'll have to let me know because my eye is still a little blurry as I'm looking down at the text here, so if I miss something, you point it out, and I'll have to go back to it. So, but we left off the last one we did was part 9, and we were in Isaiah 51, I think, and Isaiah 65, where we had looked at Jerusalem being transformed into the Garden of Eden, and Isaiah 65 talking about the new heavens and new earth, or the renewed sky and renewed land that will take place when the kingdom arrives and Jerusalem is restored, and how it talked about the days of God's people will be as the days of the tree of life, and they will dwell in Jerusalem and be given access to the tree of life once again. And we're gonna actually look in more detail at the restoration of Jerusalem in the book of Isaiah. We're gonna go through about 4 or 5 chapters in Isaiah here after this lesson, which we're going to look at more specifics on Jerusalem being restored and what that process looks like. But before we look at that, I want to look at this event that all the prophets, you know, from top to bottom describe, called the Day of the Lord. And, you know, anytime we find any terms in the scriptures that are repeated continually over and over again, we should always kind of pay attention to those terms and look and see, you know, why are all the prophets describing this specific day? And what is this day about? And this day is connected with the kingdom, because if you read we're going to read through these prophets today. We're going to first look at what some of the prophets said about the day of the Lord, but then we're going to look at the prophets kind of lay out this sequence of events that transpire immediately before the day of the Lord, and then right after the day of the Lord when the kingdom arrives and all the fulfillments occur with the Davidic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant and everything that we've been looking at thus far. But the day of the Lord describes this. It's not a really when the passages we're going to look at right now, and I want to go through. It's a very dismal day. It's a day of vengeance. It's a day of recompense for the wicked, and it describes Jerusalem. The prophets all describe Jerusalem in this state of turmoil right before this day arrives, and the wicked basically conquering and overcoming, and Jerusalem is on the verge of utter destruction yet once again. You know, you had the first destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar, second under Titus and the Romans, and it describes a third siege of Jerusalem yet once again. But it's a different, in the prophet's connect writings with the day of the Lord, this third siege is different than the others, because it actually it doesn't occur to the extent that the previous sieges, the level that those sieges existed. Basically, Jerusalem was completely destroyed by the Babylonians and Romans, but Jesus actually returns, the Messiah returns and delivers Jerusalem from this third siege before it's wiped out, and rescues this small remnant of Israelites, and basically protects the city and goes to battle against all the wicked. The wicked are going to gather in this valley called the Valley of Megiddo. It's where you get the word Armageddon. And they're going to gather in this valley, and they're going to attack Jerusalem once again. And then the prophets are all kind of describing this same type of sequence of events that occurs in that latter half of the 70th week of Daniel, which Jesus labeled in Matthew 24 as the Great Tribulation. You know, the time of tribulation such as has never been since the beginning until this time is that latter part where, you know, the wicked are you know, you have the Antichrist and you have him ruling and gaining power, and then you have this Day of the Lord event that brings judgment upon all nations. And unlike, you know, the first, you know, many of the judgments that God enacted on these nations that came against Jerusalem, like the Babylonians and the Romans and stuff, they were kind of more specific judgments for specific nations. But this Day of the Lord event, it always encompasses all nations. You know, and the book of Revelation talks about how all nations are going to be gathered together to go down to the Valley of Megiddo, and they're gathered there to fight the Messiah. You know, they're gathered there to go to war with the Lamb, as the book of Revelation says. And one of the things we need to keep in mind with regard to the kingdom, you know, before the kingdom can arrive with all the blessings and perfect peace and all the passages we've been reading about that are just, you know, perfect tranquility and peace in the earth and righteousness, there has to be a removal of that element that suppresses that ability to have that peace and righteousness, and that is the wicked. And, you know, the thing we need to realize is that the first advent of Christ, you know, John in John's gospel, you know, he records John the Baptist, you know, saying, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." But then you have, you know, as the suffering servant that came to suffer for mankind and make a way for us to have access to the kingdom. But you get to the book of Revelation, chapter 19, and John describes the second arrival of the Son, and it's going to be completely different. You know, he says he sees the sky split open, and he who sits on a white horse, and he says, "In righteousness he doth judge and make war." You know, he is coming back as a conquering king to establish this kingdom and remove the wicked. And we've looked multiple times at a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 32, the Song of Moses, in this series. I think we've discussed it, you know, two or three times. But in verses 39 through 43, it describes the event of the day of the Lord. Deuteronomy 32, 39 through 43. And, you know, it describes the day of the Lord, and, you know, Yahweh says, you know, "Know that I am that I am." He says, "I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there's no one who can deliver from my hand." Then he talks about sharpening. He says, "If I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to my enemies and repay those who hate me." And he talks about how his sword is going to be bathed in the blood of the wicked and from the heads of these leaders of these countries that come against God's people. And at the very end of that passage, you know, in verse 43, which Paul quotes in Hebrews chapter 1, he says, "But rejoice, O nations, with his people, and that all the angels of God worship him, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and render vengeance to his adversaries." And then it says he will purge out the land for his people. Or the New King James Version says that he will provide atonement for his land and his people. But it's the same concept. It's cleansing of the land of the wicked, so that the righteous can inherit the land of Canaan as promised to Abraham and dwell in it in perfect peace as per the Davidic covenant promises as well. So
that's
we're gonna.
The thing that's like that's great about like the day of the Lord is a dark day, but at the same time, it's like justice has finally come. Like, not to get political, but people are hoping with a new regime, with Trump coming in, that people will actually, that the U.S. or other countries will actually intervene in Syria and these other places where Christians are getting just persecuted. And then we see in, you know, in Revelation, like the even though it's symbolic, but the martyrs under the altar crying out, how long, O Lord, holy and true, you know, until you avenge all this. Well, that's the day that he finally avenged. So even though it's dark and it's gloomy and there's death, it's like someone's finally standing up for all the Christians and innocent that are getting slaughtered. So
yeah, you can't have justice, which God is inflexibly just and perfect. Perfect justice. You cannot have perfect justice without retribution. You have to make the wrongs right. And, you know, one of the reasons I want to look at some of these passages about what the day of the Lord is going to be look like is because, you know, I think that Christians have a very skewed view of Yahweh's character. You know, it's very one-sided. It's very New Testament grace, love, you know, and they don't spend enough time in their Old Testaments looking at just who the character of Yahweh is. You know, the prophets, although the prophets describe, like David, you know, he describes Yahweh as in Psalm 103 that he's merciful and gracious, you know, he's slow to anger and he abounds in mercy, and is as far as the heavens are above the earth, so is mercy towards those who fear him. But David also says in Psalm 7 that he's a just judge and he's angry with the wicked every day. And if the wicked man does not turn back, he's going to sharpen his sword, he's going to bend his bow and make it ready, and he also prepares instruments of death and makes his arrows into fiery shafts. Yeah, so.
Well, you go to a general principle of justice anyway. A lot of horrible things occur because there isn't more harsh, swift, just justice. You know, because, right, in a criminal justice system, things aren't really quickly and swiftly dealt with. You have a lot more suffering and evil, people being mistreated and people being victimized. Whereas up front it seems rather brutal, it protects and causes more social tranquility in the long run. It's a deception.
Yeah.
And so, they have to be removed. We have to have free will, so we can't force people to start, you know, to essentially to stop being wicked, to stop being good. So in order for the wicked to be no more and us to live in peace, like, they have to get removed. We have to do it the hard way if they're not going to change their hearts.
Like, yeah.
It's just a...
You know, yeah, and in Peter, 2 Peter 3, you know, he says that our hope as Christians, we look for a new heavens, or we look for that renewed sky and renewed land in which righteousness dwells. And you can't have that if you have a bunch of rebellious people that want to live in defiance of Yahweh and his ways. You know, nor is Yahweh going to come back to the earth, you know, nor is Christ going to come back to the earth to dwell a bunch amongst of people that haven't conformed themselves to his ways and his thinking and what, you know, who he wants to be with. You know, we don't, you know, I know many of us, we can't stand gathering around the wicked, you know, in certain settings where they're just, you know, nothing that they talk about is fruitful, and it's just one just vile thing after another. Well, God's, you know, just, I mean, he's even 10 times more, 10 million times more, you know, righteous than us, and he's not going to come and be a bunch of people like that. So with that being said, let's look at Isaiah 2, 10 through 21. I kind of selected just a, there's more passages about the day of the Lord than the ones we're looking at here. I just kind of selected a few that I thought were pertinent and kind of really describes this, the dismalness of this day. Isaiah, this is Isaiah 2. We're going to read 10 through 19. It says, "Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of a man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and Yahweh alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up. It shall be brought low upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower, and upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon the beautiful slopes. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. And the Lord shall be alone shall be exalted in that day, but the idols he shall utterly abolish." And here at verse 19, it's talking about the wicked. "They shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty when he arises to shake the earth mightily."
Just like Revelation 6.
Yeah, they're in utter fear and terror from this arrival of Yahweh to the earth. You know, and I find it interesting that you know, the wicked are crawling into these caves and holes, you know, on this day, where formerly, you know, as Hebrews 11 talks about how they wandered about in caves and dens and rocks, you know, in, or mountains and caves and dens, you know, in hiding from the, you know, in persecution of the wicked, you know, the righteous, like Elijah and those that, you know, were escaping from the wicked in those locations, and even David when he was being persecuted by Saul. But now it's a reversal. Now the wicked are the ones that are hiding and trying to get away from the terror of the Lord. Flip over to Isaiah 13. Verse 6 through 13. It says, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore all hands will be limp, every man's heart will melt, and they will be afraid. Pangs and sorrows will take hold of them. They will be in pain as a woman in childbirth. They will be amazed at one another, and their faces will be like flames. Behold, the day of the Lord comes, cruel, with both wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate." And the land here, which land is it talking about? The land of Canaan. "To lay the land desolate, and he will destroy its sinners from it." And the Greek says literally out from it. And it's talking about the land of Canaan, which we've looked at Psalm 37 so many times, you know, about how over and over in that passage, you know, that Jesus quoted in the Sermon on the Mount, the meek shall inherit the earth and or the land and delight themselves in the abundance of peace. Well, you know, Psalm 37 repeatedly talks about how, you know, it'll just a little while and the wicked will be no more. You know, the righteous are going to look carefully for his place, but it won't be found. But the meek shall inherit that land and dwell in it in an abundance of peace. And that's what, you know, this Day of the Lord event is talking about as well here, that it's the wicked, the sinners are going to be destroyed from it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its going forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. And what do you, who quoted from that?
Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus quoted from Matthew 24 about, you know, in verse 29 or 31, you know, that, you know, after the tribulation, the sky will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. Basically, the exact quotation. Yeah. And verse 11 says, I will punish the world for its iniquity, for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will halt the arrogance of the proud and lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a mortal man or mortal more rare than fine gold, and a man more than the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore, I will shake the heavens, and the earth will move out of her place, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. And Hebrews 12 also talks about this shaking of the heavens when Paul talks there about how, you know, that everything's going to be shaken so that we can receive a kingdom which won't be shaken, which will be permanent. Go over to Joel chapter 2. It says in chapter 2, verse 1, blow the trumpet in Zion and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. And again, here we're talking about Jerusalem and the land of Canaan. For the day of the Lord is coming, for it is at hand, a day of darkness and gloominess. And again, that's because of the celestial signs that Jesus mentioned. There's basically going to be pitch black darkness on the earth, leading up to Christ's return.
Kind of like the before the curtain rises.
Yeah. Right before a triumph, you know, a big stage performance, just pitch black, and then wham!
Now that I have your attention,
the sky split open, and I think that's what, you know, that when Jesus talks about they will see the sign of the Son of Man in heaven and they will mourn it. You know, I think there's gonna, because it's gonna be pitch black, there's gonna be this, you know, all focus on, I don't know how it's gonna work exactly, but focus on one person and one event where the sky peels back. Like Isaiah says, like a scroll, and all the righteous in Christ are revealed at the same time in glory. But so he says, let all the hands, it's a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, like the morning clouds spread over the mountains. A people come, great and strong, the like of whom has never been, nor will there ever be such after them, even for many successive generations. And here, in these next verses, it's talking about this angelic host that returns with the Messiah. And the angels are actually going to be the ones that are going to be doing most of the reaping, most of the separating from among the just and the wicked. You know, we read in the Gospels about the wheat and the tares, and it says that the tares are removed by the angels, you know, first when the kingdom arrives. And, you know, over and over in the Gospels and in the epistles, you read about the second coming, Jesus' arrival to the earth being accompanied by all the holy angels. You know, Jude talks about how, you know, the Lord will come with vengeance with 10,000s of his holy ones, you know. And it talks about in Matthew 25, Jesus, you know, will sit on the throne of glory and appear with his holy angels.
In Matthew 24, where it says the ones taken are the ones that angels are sweeping or over and taking.
Well, that's actually a whole nother path. That's actually not something that's going to be taking place at the second coming. That's an event that's related to the actual beginning of the abomination of desolation. That parable is it's related to the abomination of desolation and related to the just being received into places of refuge and safety, and the wicked actually being left to face certain things, you know, that happened during the tribulation. But
so that doesn't hook up with the Noah comment.
Well, it does, but I think it's Mark or Luke 12, I think, that talks about Lot's wife and remembering Lot's wife, and then Jesus connects that same teaching about one being taken, the other left, with this parable about where the eagles are there, or where the body is there, the eagles will be gathered together. Yeah, it's well, we can go over it later. But anyways, so this is talking about this angelic host that's appearing, and down here we'll see that it's called the army of the Lord. But it says, a fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, and behind them is like a desolate wilderness. So that's just, they're just like, you know, like the Song of Moses talked about purging out the land for his people. Here's the purge process. It's just going through and just cleaning it out. And it says that nothing shall escape them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like swift steeds so they run. With a noise like chariots, over the mountaintops they leap, like the noise of a flaming fire that devours the stubble, like the strong people set in battle array. Before them the people writhe in pain, and all faces are drained of color. These angels, they run like mighty men. They climb the wall like men of war. Everyone marches in formation. They don't break ranks. They do not push one another. Everyone marches in his own column. Though they lunge between the weapons, they are not cut down. They run to and fro in the city. They run on the wall. They climb into the houses. They enter at the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them. The heavens tremble. The sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars diminish their brightness. Again, same celestial signs. The Lord gives voice before his army. You know, and remember in Revelation 19 also, you see, it talks about this army following Jesus upon his arrival, clothed in white linen, fine, you know, this army that's clothed in these garments, you know, following the Lord as he returns. And it says, his camp is very great, for strong is the one who executes his word, for the day of the Lord is great and very terrible. Who can endure it? Go to Amos 5. Couple pages over, verse 18, just verse 18 through 20. Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord, for what good is the day of the Lord to you? It will be darkness and not light. It will be as though a man fled from a lion and a bear met him, or as though he went into a house, leaned his hand on the wall, and a serpent bit him. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light? Is it not very dark with no brightness in it? So basically it's saying there is no escape. There is no getting away. You know, it's describing this where like the wicked for a minute, they think they have relief. You know, like they're running into these caves and these rocks and they're like, oh, I'm gonna get away from this vengeance and this wrathful being that just showed up. And then a bear meets him in the cave. You know, there's no getting out of this day and the judgment that it brings.
Well, it reminds me of when you and I were talking about end time stuff, and there was a certain guy in the teams that was not a Christian that came up and was like, oh, I love talking about this stuff. And you and I were like, what do you mean you like talking? Like, you're the one that's going to get destroyed if you don't change your heart. Like, why would you be excited about it if you don't really believe in it, you know? It's either it means nothing or...
Yeah,
it's not gonna work out for you.
Yeah. Like we've told guys before in the platoon, like, guess what? He's coming after you. Yeah, and it doesn't matter how many mags you have on you. Yeah. Obadiah. So it's right after Amos. Obadiah 1. 15, actually, 1, we're going to read 1:15 through 2:4. Or that's wrong, hold on. No, we're just going to read Obadiah 1:15 and 16, because it's only one chapter. For the day of the Lord upon all nations is near. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. For as you drank on my holy mountain, so shall all nations drink continually. Yes, they shall drink and swallow, and they shall be as though they had never been. So, in other words, it's just this repeated judgment and vengeance being, you know, as you have done, so it's going to return upon your own head. You know, Yahweh, again, like in Deuteronomy 7, he says that, you know, he extends mercy to thousands of generations of those who love him and keep his commandments, but he repays those who hate him to their face. You know, he does not stand for rebellion and people that continually scoff at his ways.
There's a lot of so you've done and it'll be returned to you, like all the people that offered their children to the fire to Molech, and what, you know, is basically Gehenna, the same piece of land that's Gehenna, you know. Well, you're going to go there, you know. The people that threw their children into the fire are going to go into the fire there. Turn right back at him.
Yeah.
That's probably the best case of that.
You know, well, one of the passages we're not going to look at, but in Joel 3, it actually, Yahweh points out actually two specific places, Tyre and Sidon, and all the coast of Philistia, because he talks about how, you know, they gave their boys as payment for a harlot and sold their girl for wine that they may drink, and all the stuff that they did to his people. But it's strange because you read these things, and it's like Yahweh has a personal vengeance with them, you know, a personal vendetta with them, because he's like, will you retaliate against me swiftly and speedily? I'll return your retaliation upon your own head. And that's one of the things that, you know, when you read these passages about the wicked and God, you know, rendering vengeance on his enemies, it is those who his enemies are those who have made that decision to willfully, you know, this isn't taking place on people that are
ignorant,
somewhat
willfully ignorant, and then the enemies of God.
Yeah. Well, remember we talked about in Isaiah 66, when we were in Isaiah 66, and talked about how there's going to be people sent out to gather people that have not heard of his Yahweh's fame or seen his glory, and they're going to bring them up to Jerusalem to worship him. This day of the Lord, you know, Christ is not returning to enact this type of vengeance on these types of people that maybe haven't ever heard or haven't ever been exposed to the gospel. It's that nations of people gather to make war with him. I mean, whatever more of a better term could use for his enemy than people that are actually gathered there to fight him? I mean,
I think you're pretty set in your ways when God shows up and you're gnashing your teeth and wanting to do battle. Like, that's God. Like, if you're still angry and still want to fight against him, like, I don't think there's any turning back at that point, you know?
Yeah.
If you're not humbled by that, then that's the only faith for you.
And then this last passage, slip over to Zephaniah. It's a couple after Nahum and Habakkuk. Just a little over to the right a little bit. Zephaniah 1:14, and then we're going to read through chapter 2, verse 14. The great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. There the mighty men shall cry out. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of devastation and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and alarm against the fortified cities and against the high towers. I will bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men, because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like refuse. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. But the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy. For he will make a speedily riddance of all those who dwell on the land. Gather yourselves together, yes, gather together, O undesirable nation, before the decree is issued, or the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger comes upon you. Seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth. You who have upheld his justice, seek righteousness, seek humility, and it may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. So, you know, there's this call that, you know, in these passages of just devastation and darkness, you still find Yahweh extending mercy. Hey, seek mercy, seek humility. You know, you will be caught, you will be hidden in this time. You know, you will.
Pray that you will be able to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man.
Yeah, and Isaiah 26 talks about the righteous fleeing into, you know, into, like, you will be hidden. You know, you will be this secret place that you will be basically passed over. You won't receive this judgment. You know, it's like, you know, it talks about here, that day is a day of wrath, you know, and, you know, Romans 5 talks about how we've been justified by Christ's blood. We shall be saved from the wrath through him. You know, if we have joined ourselves to his Son, that wrath will be passed over us and we will be hidden when this day arrives. Now let's look at, so these are kind of just some of the more sporadic passages in the minor prophets that we've been looking at. Let's look at Zechariah 14. And we're going to actually go through the whole chapter here, because Zechariah here actually gives a very detailed sequence of events surrounding this day of the Lord. And we're kind of use Zechariah's chapter here as a to kind of go into a couple other passages too, that parallel passages that talk about the same thing. So Zechariah 14 starts off with, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming. Your spoil will be divided in your midst, for I will gather all nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city." So here, as I mentioned previously, that Jerusalem is going to be sieged yet once again. It's talking about the spoil being divided. That's talking about Jerusalem being sieged and spoil being taken. You know, women ravished. But notice it says the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And this refers to the 144,000 of Revelation 7 that are sealed, that are going to be remain within the city and have a supernatural protection from God during this time that all these nations are gathered against Jerusalem to lay siege to it once again. And so, you know, 1 and 2 here describe this siege, and then notice what happens here. You know, the siege, you know, as many of the other prophets describe about how it's going to be Jerusalem's going to be utterly destroyed, and the pagans are just going to, you know, run it over like roughshod. Now verse 3 says, then, so when, you know, when this takes place, Yahweh will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. Now, if I was reading this passage as a Jew, like in the Old Testament, I would be like, what? Yahweh's feet. Yahweh's feet on the Mount of Olives. You know, it would be, you know, it would be kind of like, what? You know, but obviously.
I think it's entirely symbolic, whereas we recognize, you know, yeah. Christ is the figure of that.
Yeah, so he's coming. So he's coming down and bam, he's going to land right in the top of the Mount of Olives. And it's going to split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Oh, and also, remember in Acts chapter 2, when Christ ascended back up to heaven in the sight of his apostles, and the angel said, this man, Jesus, this same Jesus is going to return in the same manner you saw him go. Well, where were they when that happened? On the Mount of Olives. So he's coming right back.
Touchdown right on the same axe.
Yeah, on the same axe. So it's going to make this large valley, and half the mountain's going to move toward the north, and half of it towards the south. And then it says in verse 5, you shall flee. And this you there, the pronoun there, is referring to these 144,000 Israelites that have been sealed from the 12 tribes. That's going to provide an escape route for them to flee through this valley. And they're going to flee. And it says, you're going to flee through my mountain valley, for the mountain valley shall reach to Azel. You shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And he's just referring back to this, you know, previous earthquake that happened in Israel's history that Amos talks about in Amos 1:1. Then it says, thus the Lord my God will come, and all the saints with you, or all the holy ones with you, which again is a reference to all the this angelic host that's returning with Christ. But I mean, it also Holy Ones is also used for us as well, for saints, for God's people. So it you know, we're gonna before Christ is revealed, you know, in glory, the New Testament says that we will appear with him in glory. So before that event of the sky splitting open, after, you know, it's pitch black and it splits open to reveal his glory, all the saints are going to be gathered by the angels. You know, we're going to be those who are in the dust are going to be brought up out of the graves, and then they're going to be gathered with us, and the angels are going to come and take us up to meet him.
Yeah, the First Thessalonians 4, we're caught up together with him in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. Yeah. So, well, he hasn't come down yet. So,
yeah. So
we're going to hang out up there while he comes down here. We're going to come down with him, you know. It's
yeah,
like,
what does this mean? Because if his feet already touched the mountain that splits, and then down here he will come in the same.
Well, it's just referring to he came and all the saints are with him. But so what I'm saying is that the saints could also include believers, resurrected believers as well in this giant group. And then verse 6 says, "It shall come to pass in that day that there will be no light." Again, here we have the cosmic signs. The lights will diminish. It shall be one day which is known to the Lord. And this is important if you're discussing, I mean, I don't want to get too off topic with pre-tribulational rapture and dispensationalism, but this dispensational teachers like to talk about the day of the Lord as if it's the whole tribulational period, because it conflicts with, because they have the, you know, the two stages of Christ's coming and what have you. But it's, you know, it's the in the New Testament, you know, sometimes it's called the day of Christ. You know, in fact, at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where Paul says that two things must happen before the day of the day, he says the day of Christ, but there's some variants that actually say the day of the Lord there as well. It's the same day, though, is my point. But they have to have the day of the Lord with the whole dispensational scheme mean the whole tribulational period, because it conflicts with their two stages of the coming of Christ. So, but. And, you know, and then it gets even more specific. It says it's one day known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time it shall happen that it will be light.
That wouldn't make sense for a whole period.
No.
I want to say one day. If day is a general period of time, you wouldn't say one. One irrespective period of time, undefined. Why would you define that for one period? You know, yeah. Why would you say one day? Just like the whole thing with the creation week. Why would you say on day one if it was just like roughly, yeah, but even the one too, you know, just the one, why would you give a figure to it? It'll be all in one day. Well, if you don't know how long that is, why are you just saying it's one,
you
know?
You said it would be this much time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and the other thing too is when we looked at Isaiah 2, it said the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. Well, if you have 3.5 years, you know, or whatever, or 7 years, which most of them think the tribulation, you know, if you have 3.5 years of this, the abominations that the Antichrist is performing, how can that be the day of the Lord period when it says all the idols will be abolished and only Yahweh in that day will be exalted? It doesn't fit.
Well, they're essentially saying it's age, so it would be saying it shall be one age which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening of this age.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It has to be a 24-hour day.
It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't.
Or even given that definition, how could it be?
Yeah, it doesn't work. So then, verse 8, and notice verse 8 also, it says, in that day, connecting it to this day of the Lord, it shall be that living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and half of them toward the western sea. In both summer and winter it shall occur. And the Lord shall be king, or Messiah, Christ, over all the earth. In that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name is one. Now we've talked about these living waters before, how you're going to have Jesus sitting on the throne in Jerusalem, and under his throne is going to be this stream that begins and starts to go out. And let's read it, because it's I love this passage. Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel is given this prophetic vision of what this stream is, this river is going to look like.
Ezekiel 47?
Yep, Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel talks, he's describing all these visions that he's seen of the millennium and the temple and Christ, you know, and Messiah in the temple and all these things. And he says he's brought back to the door of the temple, and there was water flowing from under the threshold of the temple toward the east. For the front of the temple faced the east. The water was flowing from under the right side of the temple south of the altar. He brought me out by way of the north gate, and led me around on the outside to the outer gateway that faces the east, and there was water running out on the right side. And when the man went out on the east with a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits and brought me through the waters, and the water came up to my ankles. Again he measured 1,000 and brought me through the waters, and the water came up to my knees. And again he measured another 1,000 and brought me through the water, and it came up to my waist. And then he did it again, and it was a river that I could not cross. For the water was too deep, water in which one must swim, a river that could not be crossed, meaning crossed by walking, it was too wide. And he said to me, Son of man, have you seen this? Then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. So this, you know, obviously this river is getting larger and larger, and because it's starting from underneath the threshold of Messiah's throne, and it's going out from there, and from there it's extending and getting larger. Then here's where he describes this water, or this stream goes into. It says, when he's on the banks of the river, he sees along the banks of the river many trees on one side of the other. And these trees are the tree of life. It's you know, the tree of life isn't, as we've talked about before, a single one tree that all the righteous are going to be partaking of. It's a quality of trees that are going to be on both sides of this river that's proceeding from Christ's throne. And Revelation 21 and 22 specifically talk about this as well. That when John is describing that vision in those passages in Revelation, he's quoting directly from Ezekiel here. And he says that, he said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region, goes down into the valley, and enters the sea. And the sea here, it's talking about the Dead Sea. That it goes down and flows into the Dead Sea. And then he says that when it reaches the Dead Sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves wherever the rivers go will live. There will be very great multitude of fish because these waters will go there. For they will be healed, and everything will live wherever the river goes. It shall be that fishermen will stand by it from En-Gedi to En-Gallim. And now En-Gedi and En-Gallim, these are actual places that are mentioned in Samuel, and where David actually fled from Saul and hid in caves. And you know, it's called the Mount, like the mountains or the hills of the billy goats, wild goat, you know, billy goats. But David actually hid out in these places. And they will be places for spreading their nets. Their fish will be of the same kinds of the fish of the great sea. And that's talking about the Mediterranean Sea. Exceedingly many. But its swamps and marshes will not be healed. They will be given over to salt. Along the banks of the river, on this side and that, will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves will not wither. Their fruit will not fail. They will bear fruit every month because their water flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food and their leaves for medicine. So here we have the fruit of the trees of life described. And we mentioned before in another lesson about how 12 different months, the fruits will bear 12 different fruits that the righteous will partake of. And the reason it says here the leaves are for the healing of the nations is because somehow the leaves are going to be used for medicinal purposes for the mortal nations that we're going to be governing during the kingdom age. So this, and this is part of this healing process. So wherever this river goes down and it heals all this, you know, all the waters and an abundance of, you know, of lush vegetation and everything, this is part of the restoration of the creation process. It begins with this water of life from the Christ throne. I had mentioned previously how when Messiah returns, he doesn't just like come down out of the clouds and bam, he's king over all the earth. You know, he comes down. There's a process that takes place where he takes the throne of David, sets up his kingdom initially from Dan to Beersheba is his authority immediately when he returns. Because of, as the day of the Lord, all the wicked are going to be purged out of the land of Canaan. That land is going to be immediately inhabited by the righteous as their inheritance and occupied by believers. But throughout the course of the millennium, the kingdom is going to extend and gain more jurisdiction and more power as this righteous king, like Psalm 2, governs the nations with the rod of iron and rebukes many nations, and they beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Well, as the Messiah's reign and the kingdom extending throughout all the earth is a process, so is the restoration of the creation a process as well. You know, Jesus doesn't just return and boom, the creation's back to normal. There's a purging process and a burning process for the land, which we read about. And then here, this water is going to slowly start to, you know, I imagine it extending into every water source on the planet somehow, and just transforming the planet back into what it was originally created and intended to be. So that's what Zechariah is describing. We can go back over to Zechariah 14. That's what Zechariah is describing here when he's talking about this: these living waters shall flow from Jerusalem. Then in verse 10 in Zechariah 14, it says, "All the land shall be turned into a plain from Geba to Rimmon, south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be raised up and inhabited in her place from Benjamin's gate to the place of the first gate and the corner gate, and from the tower of Hanel to the king's wine presses." And this is just, it's listing locations that are very known to the Israelites within the land of Israel to mark out specific things that are going to happen to that actual land. And the reason it's being turned into a plain is because it now needs to occupy many, many, many people, righteous believers that are going to inhabit it. And then it says, "The people shall dwell in it," which obviously is the righteous, "and no longer shall there be utter destruction, but Jerusalem shall be safely inhabited." And this is, again, this language is a stipulation of the Davidic covenant, where God's people would be placed in the land never to move again, and the wicked would never oppress them anymore, and Jerusalem would be a safe dwelling for God's people for the ages upon the ages. Now, Joel, you flip back over to Joel. We were in Joel earlier. Now, Joel also describes this kind of same sequence with the day of the Lord, followed by the arrival of the kingdom and all the promises being fulfilled. We were in Joel 2, but let's go over to Joel chapter 3. Verse 9. "Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare for war. Wake up the mighty men. Let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, 'I am strong.' Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord. Let the nations be wakened. Come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great." You know, and many of the prophets describe this return of Christ as, you know, Isaiah 63 describes, you know, Isaiah describes it as, you know, "Why are your garments red and stained as one who treads in the winepress?" And Revelation 19 talks about how his garments are clothed with robe dipped in blood. You know, it's this giant slaughter that's going to take place when Christ returns of the wicked. And then verse 14, "Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision." And here it's talking about the valley of Megiddo, where they're all gathering. "For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon..." And, well, here also, back to that topic about the day of the Lord being the event of Christ's return, if the valley, if this battle is about to begin and it's saying that it's still near, it obviously can't be the entire period of the tribulation. For the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon will grow dark, and the stars will diminish their brightness. The Lord will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem. The heavens and earth will shake, but the Lord will be a shelter for his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So you shall know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then Jerusalem shall be holy. No aliens shall ever pass through her again. And it shall come to pass in that day. And now, so here we have this battle that's talked about. And now the kingdom's arrived. And we have, it says that the mountains will drip with new wine. The hills shall flow with milk. All the brooks of Judah shall be flooded with water. A fountain shall flow from the house of the Lord. So now here Joel actually uses the temple, you know, describes the temple of the same fountain we looked at in Zechariah. Shall flow from the house of the Lord and water from the valley of Achaia. Egypt shall be a desolation and Edom a desolate wilderness because of the violence against the people of Judah, for they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall remain forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation, for I will acquit them of their guilt of bloodshed, whom I had not acquitted. For the Lord dwells in Zion, or Jerusalem. So we got two more passages. We'll probably just maybe read the next one. So again, Joel describes the same thing as Zechariah. You know, this day of the Lord followed by the kingdom and restoration of all things. Flip over to Amos 9. So throughout the book of Amos, we have him repeatedly talking about the day of the Lord, as we've already looked at. And notice here in verse 11, it's followed by this restoration process of the kingdom's arrival. And it says in verse 11, on that day, I will raise up the tabernacle of David, which has fallen down, and repair its damages. I will raise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old. And what it's talking about here with the tabernacle of David is, if you remember when back in Samuel and where the Philistines ended up getting possession of the Ark of the Covenant, and eventually the Philistines sent it back because it was plaguing them and doing all kinds of things that they were like, oh, we got to get this thing out of here. Went back, the Ark ended up resting in the house of Abinadab. David finally went and got the Ark from Abinadab's house and brought it. He was bringing it back to the city of David. And then a man by the name of Uzzah ended up touching the ark, and Lord struck him down. And David was like, oh boy, like we need to do something with this ark before we bring it back. So he left it in this guy's house by the name of Obed-Edom, and it stayed there, and it blessed that guy. And then David was like, okay, I can bring it up to the city of David now. So he brings up the city of David, and kind of once he brought it there, he set up the ark in like this tent, you know, like a makeshift tent. And he had a bunch of singers and dancers and people doing all kinds of stuff. Well, in Gibeon, there was the tabernacle was set up in Gibeon with the Holy of Holies and everything, you know, and there was a process for where that ark had to be and going into the Holy of Holies with the priests. But David went outside of the normal practices for these things and just set it up in a tent and worshiped God. And God accepted it and was pleased with it. So what it's talking about is that in the kingdom, you know, nations, there's going to be a form of worship that's going to be different than what it was under the law of Moses in the temple, where all nations are going to be flow up to the temple and be allowed to worship God in the house of the Lord. And that's why James in Acts chapter 15 in the Jerusalem Council, you know, he quotes from this prophecy here in Amos, and refers it to the nations coming into the faith, you know, into the promises of the Abrahamic and Davidic covenant, and how the nations are now included in those covenants. He uses this passage as a way to describe that. But anyways, so that's what the tabernacle of David is talking about. And then in verse 12 it says that they may possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations who are called by my name, says the Lord who does this thing. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes, him who sows seed. The mountains shall drip with sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will bring back the captives of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. And this is the same language that we've looked at previously in like Isaiah 65. And they shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them. I will plant them in their land. They shall no longer shall they be pulled up from the land I have given them, says the Lord your God. And the Greek here is, when it says no longer shall they be pulled up, it uses this emphatic double negation, basically meaning they shall absolutely not be pulled up any longer. And this is also, as we've looked at repeatedly, the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant promise with having perfect peace in Jerusalem and inhabiting it forever. Well, let's look at the last passage here in Zephaniah, and then we'll be done. Do you guys have any questions about that, about any of these prophecies?
I have one.
Yep.
So eventually there are no mortals on the earth.
Eventually, yes. Eventually, after that thousand-year period, in Revelation 20, you have this final judgment, the second resurrection, or sometimes referred to as the general resurrection of all the wicked. After that, we don't really know. We're not given a whole lot of information about. We know that the kingdom is permanent. You know, we know that, like Isaiah 9, that of the government and his of the government and of his peace and rule there shall be no end. Like, we know the kingdom is on the earth.
There can never be sin again on the earth after that.
You mean after the millennium?
Yeah.
After the millennium? No. Yeah. So only those. Yeah, there will be only those having access to immortality at that time. You know, there will not be any nations on the earth still left over. The last passage is Zephaniah 3, 8 through 15. Zephaniah, again, just go over to the right a little bit, past Micah and Nahum. Verse 8. Therefore, wait for me, says the Lord, until the day I rise up for plunder. My determination is to gather the nations to my assembly of kingdoms, to pour on them my indignation, all my fierce anger. All the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. For then I will restore to the peoples a pure language, that they may call on the name of the Lord, to serve him with one accord. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my worshippers, the daughter of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offering. In that day you shall not be shamed for any of your deeds in which you transgress against me. For then I will take away from your midst those who rejoice in your pride, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain, which is Jerusalem. I will leave in your midst a meek and humble people, that they shall trust in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel shall do no unrighteousness and speak no lies, nor shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth. And the reason this is talking about the remnant of Israel is because when the kingdom arrives, there won't be any Israelites left over that are not righteous. All will be righteous dwelling in the land. All those amongst Israel that were wicked will be cut off just like any of the other wicked. For they shall feed their flocks and lie down, and no one shall make them afraid. Again, repeating over and over again these Davidic covenant promises. Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all your heart. O daughter of Jerusalem, the Lord has taken away your judgments. He has cast out your enemy. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall see disaster no more. So, again, you know, this total peace, this total prosperity and peace for God's people, and they will never be oppressed by the wicked any longer. So that is, if you read through the prophets, you're going to continue. I mean, I only briefly kind of touched the surface of these ones I thought maybe were the one, you know, more pertinent ones, but literally it's every prophet. This is the same thing over and over again, is this day of the Lord and these kingdom promises coming to fulfillment. And these things haven't happened yet. And we're waiting for them to happen. And some of us in this room are going to be lucky enough to see them happen. So, you guys have any questions? All right, we'll stop there.